Good morning. Excuse me. As the image behind me would imply, we're going back to the book of Acts, just like last week. And we're doing that because, for whatever reason, it falls in the lectionary to read Acts 17, and that's often one of a pastor's favorite passages from the New Testament. It just, that's how it works, and for reasons that we'll hopefully see in a minute. Paul, the apostle, is waiting for some people. He kind of got run out of town, which happens more often than not. And so he's waiting for some people. He finds himself in Athens. And Athens is, or was, really the kind of the intellectual capital of the region, in a way that doesn't have kind of an obvious analog to the United States. Maybe if you like focus in on industry or something like that, that would help. So if you think of like technology, you think San Francisco Peninsula, oil and gas, you think Houston, film and TV, you probably think LA, music, you think Nashville, stuff like that. Athens was all of it. They got made fun of it, justifiably so, in all kinds of Greek and Roman writing. Athenians were accused of constantly talking, for example, and so interested in the next thing and the new idea that their brains just sort of fall out. That's Athens. And so Paul finds himself in the city, and he's waiting for some people. He has nothing better to do, so he does what he always does. He wanders around and starts talking with people. He goes to the synagogue, as you'd expect. He connects with his fellow Judeans or Jews, and he also notices that the city is filled with idols, religious icons. Now, these idols would be kind of like the Greco-Roman pantheon. So think Zeus and, well, Athena, hence the name of the city, and everybody else in between. And as a Jewish person, and especially as a Jewish person following Jesus, this is the opposite of everything that he believes. The opposite of Christianity, for example, is not atheism, at least according to the Bible. The opposite of Christianity is idolatry, or worshiping anything other than God as revealed by Jesus. And so it grieves him, it hurts him, but at the same time, because Athenians love to talk, he finds himself in the marketplace, where that sort of thing happens constantly. I hesitate to use the analogy for so many reasons, but in this situation, Paul would be like a pig in excrement. But calling him a pig, considering he's Jewish, and yeah, whatever. There's a lot of things wrong with that, but that's exactly what he is. And he encounters a couple of groups of people. He encounters the Epicureans and the Stoics. And we're not going to get deep into who they are, but imagine it like this. A Stoic is one who, rather than one who shows no emotion in that time in history, that will come later. A Stoic is the one who believes that the world is infused with the divine. The gods are in and involved with everything in a very meticulous way. If you are an Epicurean, you have the exact opposite view. The gods, or God, or the divine, wound up the system that we know of as the world, or the cosmos, and then let it run while they stayed very far back and did not intervene. At least not very much at all. The modern-ish version of Epicureanism would be deism, which believes that God is like this clockmaker, wound the clock up and just let it run, but didn't really intervene. The most famous deist of all, of course, at least in the United States, would be Thomas Jefferson, who famously took the Gospels, stories of Jesus, and cut out anything that had to do with the supernatural because he liked Jesus' teaching, but he didn't believe in all of that spooky nonsense. That's deism, like almost by definition. So in other words, you have competing, like polar opposite ideas. And then there's Paul, happy to stand in the middle. Eventually they say, what is this babbler saying? That's not a compliment in any sense. And so they bring him before what's called the Areopagus. And apologies to Dave, I don't remember, I don't know where you went, but yeah, Areopagus, there's a couple of weird words in this one. If you've ever heard Mars Hill, it's the same phrase, just it's kind of a Latin versus Greek kind of thing. And the Areopagus was the location of the Athenian ruling council. They run the city, they're the high intelligentsia, they're the extremely learned, stuffy, stodgy old men. If you have done any kind of reading, whether for pleasure or by force, about, say, Socrates, you might remember that this was the same ruling council that sentenced him to death. And he did, and they sent, his charges were two. One was corrupting the youth, and the other was worshiping foreign divinities, which is exactly the situation that Paul is accused of. Now, I don't know if they're looking to execute him, probably not, but I think we're meant to hear some parallels there. This could go wrong for Paul in a few different ways. If you're a very careful listener and reader, you would notice that they said, wait, he's talking about like foreign gods, plural. And Luke says, because he was talking about Jesus and the resurrection. Jesus, that's a masculine noun. Anastasis, the resurrection, is feminine. So it seems like they're thinking he's talking about this husband-wife divine pair or something like that. Now, initially, we might want to say, no, hold on, guys. Let me explain very carefully what we're talking about. Paul does no such thing. Because Paul, among many other things, is a master at reading the room and speaking in a way that the people around him can hear. And that's ultimately where we're going with this morning. He's also a master at starting riots, but I don't think he does that on purpose. And he pays dearly for those. So they bring him up. Now, in the book of Acts, every time Paul gives a speech, what he says is very dependent on who he's talking to. If he's talking to Jewish people, he will begin with our father Abraham or something like that. If he said that to a bunch of Greeks, they would say, who? So he doesn't. He talks about creation. He talks about how God placed everything in order. And there are moments where the Epicureans would be like, okay, I like this. And and there are other moments where the Stoics would say, all right, I like where he's going. But Paul has already stabbed them with a knife, and he's going to twist it in a minute. So he goes on and on. And he then says, well, hey, you know, some of your own poets have said similar things. Like, we are indeed his offspring, and in him we live, move, and have our being. He's literally quoting Greek poets. Only in the original Greek writings, all of those things were actually said about Zeus. Isn't that weird? It can be weird. It would be like if I got up here and started reading from the Quran because I thought that it had something to tell us about the nature of God. I wouldn't necessarily be factually incorrect, but it could be very uncomfortable. That's exactly what Paul is doing here, only he's flipping it around. And his point being that the cultural imagination of the Athenian people has in some ways been infused with these moments, these ideas, these concepts that actually speak to who their creator really is. Only they don't know it. We're going to come back to that idea and connect it to what Paul is doing as he's reading the room, because it has a lot to say for us today, just in our cultural moment. But for the sake of rounding out the story, Paul then, he knows exactly what he's doing. He says he's appointed a time, and now God commands everyone to repent. He's appointed a judge, and he has proven that this is the one to judge the world because he raised him from the dead. Now, we don't have the rest of the story in the lectionary. I don't know why they left it out. It seems strange to me, but they also did not ask me, as if they would. Because once Paul says the resurrection, you get a bunch of people going, absolutely not. This is ridiculous. You get a couple of people going, I want to hear more. And then you get one or two people who, by name, who say, all right, I'm buying what you're selling. I like this idea. But the concept of resurrection is the sticking point. And this is where we see Paul's genius at reading the room and understanding his culture. In a Greek play by a Greek playwright called Aeschylus, that's his name, and the play is called the Eumenides. You don't need to remember any of that unless you're a giant nerd. The writer Aeschylus describes the founding of the Areopagus, this ruling council that Paul is standing in front of. And the playwright, has the god Apollo. Maybe you remember him from Disney cartoons or something, I don't know. And in the founding of that council, Apollo says these lines. He says, when a man dies and his blood is soaked into the ground and he is surely dead. In Greek, he says, ouk est anastasis. And in English, that says, there is no resurrection. That is one of their founding statements. And Paul is saying, guess what? There was a man from Galilee, and in Jerusalem he was killed, and God raised him from the dead. It is specifically counter to their idea that death always has the final word, that is part of like their origin story of their like ruling body. So naturally it's going to be provocative. So why is this passage such a beloved, famous section, especially for theologians and New Testament nerds? And it's because what Paul is doing here is presenting a model or a way for Christians throughout the millennia to engage with the culture around them. And to get at that, I would ask you, what stories is our culture telling right now? Because there are different stories in different eras that our culture tells that, whether we realize it or not, and often we don't, reflects these inner desires that we may not even know we have. Or they also can reflect these unnamed fears that are lurking beneath the surface. It's actually kind of obvious once you think about it, but in terms of like reflecting our fears or these things that we're deeply uncertain of, the obvious answer is Spider-Man. I mean, I don't need to elaborate, but I will. the original Spider-Man became Spider-Man by being bit by a spider that was what? Radioactive. Remember the era that those stories started coming out? The era of the Cold War, when it felt like the fingers were on the buttons and we were all going to get nuked at any time? Well, that was one of our major fears. And whether intended or not, it worked its way into this story. And it represents a kind of uncertainty. Well, you move more to like the early 2000s, my generation. The spider that bit Peter Parker to become Spider-Man was genetically modified and engineered. Right around the time that those processes were starting to develop. And there was and continues to be a lot of uncertainty and fear, but also promise and hope. And so naturally it works our way into our stories. The next iterations of Spider-Man get way more bizarre, and there's multiverses, and we're not even going to go there. But it reflects our idea, I think anyway, our questions about reality itself. Like, what is real and how do we know it? That's just one example. And so one of the things that Christians, followers of Jesus, have had to do over our 2,000-year history is first ask, what is our culture, our values, our stories, our fears, our hopes, our dreams, the things that keep us up at night? How is that reflected in our case, like the movies that we watch and come to love that really resonate with us? And if we can pinpoint those, how do we bring Jesus in a way that's authentic to who Jesus really is? And how do we do that in a way that actually touches on the hopes, dreams, and fears of our culture? Now, our cultural moment is chaotic, at the very least. Our culture is becoming increasingly fragmented, and I feel like I've been saying that for 20 years, and it keeps getting worse. I don't know. And especially right now, there's a little hope to be found. And by that, I don't mean you turn on the news and hate everything you see. It's more that you turn on the news and see nothing but chaos. Chaos, conflict, uncertainty. And in some ways, those can be more destructive than fear, because those things produce, I think anyway, a deeper kind of fear that's really, really hard to name. And so it makes perfect sense that some of the stories that our culture is telling, some of the movies that really resonate with people, are the opposite of that. I'm thinking, for example, of one where I saw, I don't remember when I saw it, it was the last couple of months, but Project Hail Mary with Ryan Gosling. It was a little too good looking, I think, but whatever. That's my own issue. As a guy, you know, it's like, come on. okay, I'm just going to stop. not enough caffeine this morning. Cool. If you haven't seen it, I really recommend it. It is a story of unbridled optimism in the face of almost certain defeat. It's a story that says no matter how bad things get, there is always hope. And that resonates. Go back, 20-ish years, when the big movies were like The Lord of the Rings and some of the superhero movies were starting to develop in a certain direction. Those stories are all about hope. And that was also a time where there were these complicated wars happening and the economy was getting worse and worse. And, of course, the message that our culture desperately was seeking was, can there be hope when there is almost certain destruction and defeat all around us? Now, nobody told us to go see those movies. Nobody told us to read these particular books. They just resonated. And it is our job to ask, why? What deeper need do we feel that we are struggling to name that somehow gets answered or somehow resonates with the stories that we watch, read, consume, whatever? That's all Paul is doing. As I like to say sometimes, if you say take a long narrative arc that really ultimately centers around one person, And throughout all the machinations and comings and goings of evil as it continues to seep into and corrupt the world, all of that evil starts to put its sights on one particular person. And the entire narrative arc hinges on an act of self-sacrifice and death for that particular person, leading to a resurrection event, which then leads to the defeat of evil. I'm, of course, talking about Harry Potter. There's a reason why, however, those stories resonated with people. There is some deep truth in that narrative arc. And if we listen very carefully to what Paul is saying as he's talking about the comings and goings of all of humanity, there is this sense in which he is assuming that the hope that God offers, the ultimate hope, is working its way into our stories and into our hearts so that one day when the people encounter it face to face, that's our job, by the way, we would say, oh, that's what I've been waiting for. So the challenge of Acts 17 is simply to do that. To learn to listen to the hopes and fears and dreams and some of those deeper things happening within our culture. And learning to address them with the hope of resurrection. Now, there's a couple of ways we can do this now in our cultural moment, which, again, and I'm not taking sides, it's just chaotic. And it feels like it just gets weirder and stranger and more uncertain. It feels like you hear conflicting, truly polar opposite ideas and interpretations of the same event, depending on who you listen to. And it's a mess. So how do we address that? Well, first off, Jesus is still king. We'll see how things play out, but there's a reason why the different iterations of like the King Arthur legend, you know, the king who's returned to his people or returned to his throne or puts everything kind of back together. There's a reason why those resonate throughout the generations. But I wonder if those stories are going to start coming back out. Because we're longing for somebody to come up, somebody who actually has the authority to say and truly mean that everything's going to be okay in spite of how difficult things get. Well, that's the hope of resurrection. That's the hope that all humanity has longed for ever since we've existed. Death is always that final great enemy. And the resurrection of Jesus is opposed to death in its face. Some of the other, I think, cultural questions that are starting to come out more and more is this idea of identity and purpose. I mean, as we become more fractured this is especially an issue in the West, so Europe, the United States, and so on. There's this loss of connection to deeper story. You know, 70, 80, 90 years ago, regardless of your religious convictions, most people had this, in some sense, connection to these bigger, maybe slightly more Christian stories or American stories or something like that. That doesn't exist anymore. And the answer, the attempt at an answer, has been, well, I create my own meaning. I create my own sense of purpose. Okay, fine, I guess. But how's that working? Are you okay, or are you truly flourishing? I don't know about you, but I don't always trust myself to make a peanut butter and jelly sandwich. Because I'm going to get peanut butter or jelly everywhere, and then ants will come and whatever. yeah. So do I really want to be the one in charge of defining my own destiny and sense of purpose and meaning? That's dangerous, because I know myself. I suspect I'm not the only one here. So maybe another way of talking about the Christian hope, the hope we have in Jesus, is by saying, I know of somebody who has called us into a deeper and more meaningful sense of being and existence and purpose. And rather than doing it as a power play or as an authoritarian or simply just being angry up in the sky and telling people who are going to hell and unless you do exactly what I say and so on and so forth, that's kind of a corruption of the Christian story. Rather, he is inviting us into a better way to live. It begins first, ironically, with our death. Die in the waters of baptism and you will find life. Because you will be united with the one who defeated death. You will be connected to the one who then loves you unconditionally and without end. Who has called you to be that light wherever you happen to go. To tell not only your story, but whatever other stories you can find that resonate with people to point them to the one who defeated death. Now, in some way, I'm supposed to say Happy Mother's Day. Sure, Happy Mother's Day. to all the mothers and mother figures, for sure. And so it doesn't fit, so, you know, end thought there. But what if Christians who have started for a little while now siloing ourselves in the art that we create? What if instead we kick those walls down and learn to listen to the stories that the people around us are telling and the culture is telling, and learn to listen a little deeper and find out what resonates with people? Because if we follow the one who has defeated death and been raised from the dead and did so within the confines of human life, then we can find a way to communicate this ultimate good news everywhere we go. That is our challenge. It'll be one of the few times I say, therefore, as we leave, go and do that. Amen. As you are able, please rise.